Tech stocks down for a second day in a row after Jay Powell is reappointed as Fed chair. Yields are rising, but the big story in financial markets as we come to you today, energy markets responding to an unprecedented release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which the United States did in coordination with China, India, South Korea, Japan, and Britain. Welcome to Alpha Trader, Aaron Task and Stephen Alfer, coming to you on the eve of Thanksgiving. And in the spirit of Thanksgiving, we are grateful to have Jim Uriel back on the show. Jim is the managing director of TJM Institutional Services and a veteran futures and options trader. Jim, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Thank you for having me. That was such a nice introduction. I'm grateful for you guys too. Thank you.
Thank you. I was working on it before we started recording. Okay, so the release of the SPRO was telegraphed, but it was bigger than anyone expected. Oil prices were down in advance, and then afterwards, they've since rebounded. We are speaking midday on Tuesday here. And what do you make of the, you know, I was always taught it's not the news that matters, it's the market's reaction to the news that matters. And right now, crude's up West Texas 2.3%. It's at 78.55. It was below 76 heading into the announcement. What's your take on this move in crude here?
Well, you kind of hit it on the head. The saying that we always use, which I hate the way it sounds, but it's true, is you buy the rumor, sell the fact, or buy the rumor, sell the news. And that's exactly what it is. It was very, very telegraphed, as you put it in. One thing I respect about the government choosing the timing that they did is that crude had started lower about a couple of weeks ago, and they sold into, or they added supply into a price declining market. It seemed like good timing, but the reality was everybody knew about it going in. So when we hit 75, it was a pretty good technical level support. So to me, it seemed like it didn't have enough oomph to push it below that. So it was a buy. People who follow me on Twitter, I tried to buy it and had a glitch up with my machine, and then it was amazing. I went to buy it, an options package, and then it was about 6 minutes later, it was a buck and a half higher. So again, it's a bang, bang game, like we say, but this to me, actually this week, things are making sense. It doesn't mean I'm printing money or anything, but things are making sense. They played their card and the market bounced back.
Interesting. So hold that thought for a second about things making sense, because that's a rarity. So real world education here. You're a veteran trader. You tried to put on a trade. There was an issue, technological or fat finger, whatever it was. It didn't go through. Then it started running away from you. So what did you do at that point?
Nothing. Because it's like, it's so funny. And I'm sure a lot of traders think the same way I do. It's like, as soon as I pressed the button, I didn't have permission because it was a weekly option that I hadn't traded in a while or something, or this account I hadn't traded it in, and it said not permitted. And it takes me about an hour to get permission for it. But anyway, so for me, I always think there's other ways I can do it. But as soon as the market says don't do it, I get a little nervous. Like what? And then all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, it was gone. So these kind of things happen. A lot of people think that people who trade a lot don't run into these issues because everything's streamlined. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you feel.
That's why I asked you, because it sounds like the kind of thing that happens to me, or the non-professional trader. But it happens to you guys too. So I guess that makes me feel better. But the key message is then you just said, okay, I'm moving on to the next thing. You didn't dwell on.
Exactly. And I'm glad me losing money or not making money makes you feel better. Is that good? I can be thankful for that too.
I'm really curious, what else is making sense to you right now?
Okay, so let's think of how this played out on Monday when they announced that Jay Powell was going to be the pick instead of Lyle Brainard. So the market reacted in an interesting and very, very predictable way. The stock market liked it. The stock market thought, okay, it's better. The devil we know is better than the devil we don't. The rates went up across the board. Not that Jay Powell's any sort of huge inflation fighter, but everything's a relative game. And relative to Lyle Brainard, he seems relatively hawkish. I still think he's way too dovish for the situation, but again, we're just comparing the Lyle Brainard. So all of a sudden, the stock market likes it. Rates start to go up, but then rates continue to go up throughout the day. NASDAQ growth stocks hate higher rates. So they were kind of in the tank the whole time. But then towards the end of the day, the stock market's like, yeah, we're great. It's great that things are going to be as planned, but we don't like higher rates. So all of a sudden, the stock market took it as a time to correct. And I think this is the beginning of a 4.5 to 5% correction in the S&P. The way we traded on Monday, making a higher high, then a lower low, closing on the beat low, and then having Tuesday confirm it. So I'm pretty short right now.
You're pretty short right now. So sorry, short S&P 500 futures, or can you be more specific?
I am. Yes, I'm short S&P 500. The futures is what I'm in. But the reality, it should have been, if I was, you know, because you always look back and kick yourself a little bit, that my short should have been in the NASDAQ, because that's the one that's going to get the double whammy of, you know, a corrective phase across the board, plus the fact that the NASDAQ hates higher rates. And there's a lot of built up positions in those names. So those names could suffer the worst. But I got my position. I like my position. I just, in retrospect, should have put it in the NASDAQ.
Are you shorting individual names or the averages? I don't know if you guys saw this morning, somebody posted a list with the NASDAQ basically at all-time highs or within a few clicks of it. There's a large and growing list. It's 25, 30 names, well-known names, some big cap stocks too, that are off between 40 and 90%. And pretty remarkable that the main gauge, the NASDAQ, is able to stay at all-time highs given that.
I agree. And I did not short any individual names. Some of them terrify me. You know, you short Tesla and the next day you could be wearing that pretty hard. So I just was trading the indexes this week. I do trade individual names, but I've kind of laid off them because I thought the bigger, broader stories generally mean bigger, broader moves. So that's why I wanted to trade the broad index.
Right. So just I saw a similar list, I think a shorter version from Charlie Bilello, and some of these names. Yeah. PayPal. This was before today, down 37% from its high. Twitter, similarly, Snap, Chewy, Lyft, Palantir, DraftKings, Pinterest. They're all down around between 38 and 50% from their highs. And then it gets worse as you go further down the list. Zoom was down 55% before today's big sell off. So the question that I've heard being discussed, and Jim, want to get your perspective on this. You have this issue, you know, the average stock has not done well. NASDAQ 52-week lows this week, we're at the lowest level or the highest number since March 2020. And yet, as Stephen just referenced, the index is at or near an all-time high. Some people look at that and say, that's a big problem. That's telling you things are getting, the fundamentals are getting shaky. And others would say we've had these rolling corrections now for a couple of years in different sectors, and that's healthy. What is your big picture view on that?
I think it's more worrying than healthy when a few names are doing so much of the heavy lifting. Now, a lot of those names you mentioned, and I'm not going to call any of those meme stocks, but I am going to say that when you inject so much money into the system globally, it ends up in weird spots and has things trading at very, very weird valuations. And some of those names obviously didn't justify the levels they were at. But you know, Peloton you mentioned too, which is an interesting thing. We kind of christened that as the stay-at-home workout stock. And when there's lots of loose money sloshing around, it rushes to things quickly and doesn't always consider the full story. Do I think that a few names, which has been kind of the whole time, you really can make an argument that at different moments there was way too much heavy lifting being done by the Amazons of the world? And I don't think that's a great thing. I think that makes it fundamentally shaky to me.
Okay, but again, just to go back a step, you're short and you're expecting a 4 to 5% correction. You're not
right,
this is the big one.
No, you know, it's so funny is that everybody who's my age, and I think you guys are probably a little bit younger than us, but when a correction begins, you always start to think, well, is this the big one? No, it's not the big one. The two big ones we've seen, you know, the tech stock and real estate, those were leveraged positions that have been built up for years and years and years. No, I don't think we're in that. As soon as my brother-in-law, who's a plumber, starts telling me, you know, how he's mortgaged everything to buy a certain asset, that's when I'll start to worry about the big one. I think we're in just a normal corrective phase. If it gets to 4.5% lower in the S&P and it still looks a little shaky to me, then I'll evaluate at the time. But right now, I don't think it's the big one.
And well, there was another big one, and that was in the mid 70s, and that came apart because the Fed, after trying to paper over it with, you know, bad monetary policy and Nixon with bad fiscal policy for many years, finally threw up its hands and just jacked interest rates up, and the averages fell about 50%, with many of the kind of the high flyers down 90% or more. And, you know, you, Aaron, and I kind of joked over the weekend about a St. Louis Fed post about, hey, if prices for turkey are too high this year, you know, switch to beans. They're way cheaper and they have a lot more protein. You know, we can joke about how just brain dead those guys are. And, you know, the Fed employees.
Oh, good.
Right. 25,000 people making an average of 125,000 a year with COLA increases. So they've got no issues. We could joke about that all day long. But like, we're at the stage now where inflation's a thing. And the next stage to me is going to be bad government policy, right? And remember what happened in the 70s, you know, Nixon with the wage and price controls, which only made it worse. And then Jerry Ford with his, you know, whip inflation now buttons, which didn't do squat. And we ended up with Jimmy Carter sitting around in the sweater telling us to turn our thermostats down. So yeah. What's worrying to me is like we're about to embark on like the bad policy period in response to some ugly inflation numbers.
Okay. So here, this is really interesting what you say, because I've been arguing that realistically since the mid 80s, the Fed's main job is to keep rates inorganically low to make up for bad government policy. And I'm not just talking about bad federal government policy. I mean, if you have a small business in a state like mine in Illinois, you are regulated and taxed almost to a punitive level by the federal government, the state, the county, and even the municipality. So we're in a situation where low rates had to be kept that way to keep things from falling apart. And I don't know exactly what falling apart looks like yet. I'm trying to piece that together. So, but now the question becomes, are we at the inflection point where we can no longer have low rates, no longer have government profligate spending like we have because of the inflation we've seen? And I am the first to admit that the supply issues have fed this inflation quite a bit. But the reality of it is monetary policy and excessive fiscal policy might at some point in time is going to become coming to its natural end. And I worry quite a bit about that. I don't think it's today. I think we have room. And again, market position is an enormous thing. This is going to sound weird, but I think the $3 trillion crypto market has pulled some of the bubble, the air out of what could have potentially been in other bubbles where it mattered more. You know, real estate's a $40 trillion market. So $3 trillion, I don't know, makes a huge difference in that. But if you throw that $3 trillion into something else, you know, maybe those tech names we were saying, then all of a sudden you have a bubble thing. So I think that it's proved to be somewhat of a regulator. Does that make any sense?
It does. And I do want to talk to you about crypto, because when past times you've been on the show, you've been generally speaking bullish. So I guess the question is, have you been buying more as Bitcoin has fallen from its recent highs down below 60,000? It was bouncing earlier today. You know, there, technically speaking, I believe that around 52,000 was a key level for it. And it held above that for sure.
Yeah. I still am involved in crypto. There's a couple things that have changed in that market recently that I think are interesting, and I'll get to them in 1 second. But I don't like trade it like a day trader. I do invest in crypto as a dollar hedge. I'm going to stop when I get about 2 to 2.5% of my net investable in crypto, which I don't quite have that yet, but I buy it like regularly, like once a week. And now I only buy Bitcoin and Ethereum. So now Bitcoin and Ethereum for the last, since 2017, have jogged between having between 45% of the total market cap of crypto up to 80 and now at about 62. Now, what's more interesting to me is back in 2017, the next highest coin was Ripple that had about 18% of the market cap. Now, the next highest coin is a Binance coin, which has like 3.5%. If I'm talking too fast, by the way, you guys can tell me to slow down or shut up or something. But so 3.5%. So the distance from the next coin is greater, and the price correlation between Ethereum and Bitcoin has tightened up a lot since May. So to make a long story short, which I know that it's too late for that, what I'm saying is that I believe the market is saying Bitcoin and Ethereum have kind of won this battle, and they're the ones that trade together and they're the big dogs in this, and all these other 1,000 coins can fight along with the speculative money, and Bitcoin and Ethereum are actually the real deal. So I'm going to stick more with them and go with them. And again, if I have 2% of my money in it, if I lose all that money, it's a dollar hedge. I don't mind that much, because I'm worried, genuinely worried about a nasty sort of dollar come to Jesus moment, just based on poor stewardship of our currency over these years.
Okay, that was a lot in a short period of time.
Is it too much? Too much? No, I break that back down again? Or
I think I got it. Let's just recap. So you're basically saying the share of crypto dollars that are now in Bitcoin and Ethereum has grown, and the spread between them and their next largest competitor has also grown. So to you, they've established themselves as the big dog in that world, and all the quote unquote altcoins or SHIT coins that are out there, you would avoid, I'm assuming.
I would avoid, because to me, that's just like betting, you know, taking your coins and betting it on red and spinning the wheel. To me, those things are just, everyone's looking for the next big thing. That to me is far more, you know, speculative, crazy money, whatever. Let the kids play with those. And I hope they make $1 billion on Shibu Inu or whatever the hell they are, but I don't care.
Right. And you're also not, yes, it does. But you're also not a so-called Bitcoin maximalist, where you only believe in Bitcoin as the only true crypto out there.
No. It's like a cult, isn't it? When you hear those guys talk. And I work with a couple of them. Actually, one of my partners who's one of those guys can hear me talking right now, and he's giving me the evil eye. But yeah, they're cultish. They're cultish. And by the way, he's made a lot of money, and so is Michael Saylor, and so is all the other Bitcoin cult people. And that's wonderful. When they start saying things like, you see them on Twitter, like saying, Bitcoin and gold can't exist together. Bitcoin has no allies. Shut up. You know what I mean? Of course they can exist together. Who the hell are you telling me what can or can't exist together? Now, gold, as you know, since rates have gone up, I'm sure you guys have seen gold's been pummeled worse than anything else. I still like the gold and silver trade in my dollar hedge portfolio, but it's not the happy days for it right now.
Right, which is, you know, again, I think people have had thoughtful conversations, I'll put it, as opposed to the cultish conversations about whether Bitcoin has replaced gold as that inflation hedge in people's portfolios. Do you see any evidence of that beyond the price action?
Yeah, no, I do believe that Bitcoin and Ethereum have replaced a lot of the dollar hedge worry. They've taken it away from gold. Now, to put in perspective, gold is a $10 trillion market cap. Now, crypto's come to a $3 trillion market cap. That's a big deal. That's a big portion of it in a short amount of time. Crypto market cap, I believe, is bigger than the silver, platinum, and palladium market caps all put together. Now, people are listening to that. I'm not in front of my Bloomberg terminal right now. I believe that to be true, but I'm not 100% certain of it. But the point is still the same, is that, of course, it's taken away some of the dollar hedge status of gold and silver, because these are the precious metals trade. And I know silver is industrial as well, but the precious metal trade is just based on faith anyway. You know, you can't eat gold, and we barely use it for anything industrial processes anyway. It's just about what we all believe is going to be worth something. And right now, that belief is not red hot, but it could get changed at any moment, I think.
And I'm glad you mentioned the dollar and your Bitcoin chat, because the dollar is rocking and rolling right now, and it's broken through some what we thought were some key technical levels, at which point we thought maybe the stock market would have troubles. Is that telling you that there's going to be sooner than expected tighter monetary policy, or the dollar doesn't exist in a vacuum? It's measured against, you know, a number of currencies, but mostly the euro and the yen. Does that just tell you that the euro and the yen are just bigger messes now?
It's mostly telling me that the euro and yen are bigger messes. That dollar index, and I've been arguing about this, I just gave a speech about this in the New Orleans Investment Conference about a month ago. That when the dollar index was set up, I don't think they had the foresight to realize that the euro and the yen were going to eventually be like 73% of the entire dollar index. So mostly I don't look at it, because obviously Europe is a mess right now. They're going into more lockdowns. It seems like a mess in many different ways. That being said, I don't think it's a total waste to look at the dollar index. And I do think it's saying that there's going to be tighter monetary policy. And I think we're seeing it already just after the appointment of Jay Powell as the Fed, or the announcement or whatever it was, we pulled forward the first tightening from like July, August of last year, of next year, to May of next year. So we pulled it forward like 2 months in the market. So the market does believe that Jay Powell is going to be at least mildly serious about fighting inflation until things change. And by the way, when I say until things change, in my head, I'm thinking if there's a 10 to 12% stock market correction, we know from past experience that the Fed thinks that's a big enough deal to stop any sort of tightening measures.
So, Jim, before we're going to take a quick break. Before we do that, though, so we have heard you say those things about the dollar index in the past, and I don't know if we've asked you directly then. So how do you measure the dollar? And please don't say by height.
I don't make any height jokes. I don't know if you guys have ever stood next to me, but I'm offended by height jokes.
That was a Caddyshack reference for those of you.
I love it.
I know you got it. No. And I know Stephen got it because we're old enough to get that. But, you know, the year when the yen make up 70%+ of the DXY, I get why you would say, not sure I really trust that. But what do you measure the dollar against?
Well, I was jokingly call it the JI dollar index, which is 12 things that we actually buy. And that's cotton, corn, coffee, lumber, cars, housing. And if you measure it against all those things, and this is again on calculations that were based on a couple of weeks ago, and there's a few others. And I leave out used cars and cryptocurrency because it would really make it look dire. But I believe that the dollar's probably lost about 25% of its purchasing power in the last 2 years since pre-pandemic. So the dollar is declining in value, whether the dollar index shows it or not.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more Alpha Trader. Welcome back to Alpha Trader. Aaron Task and Stephen Alford, continuing our conversation with Jim Urio, Director of TJM Institutional Services. And Jim, I want to pick up on a point you just made about the dollar and how you measure it, mainly versus real stuff that people buy, which brings us to the inflation story that you referenced it earlier, that a lot of it had to do with supply chain issues, which many folks are saying we've reached peak bottleneck and it's going to improve itself over the course of the next 3 to 6 months, let's call it. But you, I believe, well, I know, I think from your Twitter feed, you are generally concerned or genuinely concerned about inflation as we get into 2022. We had Lacey Hunt on here last week. He's more on the deflation camp. Why do you think that this inflation will not prove to be transitory, which is a word that's rapidly becoming a joke anyway?
Right. Because it already hasn't proven to be transitory. And it doesn't seem like the federal government even understands their role in it. They passed I don't know if they passed it completely yet, but a $1.75 trillion social spending package that they've said to us is supposed to curtail inflation. So I don't know if they just don't understand economics or what it is. I mean, just imagine throwing $2 trillion into the market of price insensitive knuckleheads who just buy stuff and then claiming that it's not inflationary. By the way, Lacey Hunt, I think, is a genius, by the way, and I will go back and listen to his take on deflation, but I'm not convinced yet. And by the way, I've been saying for a year and a half that it's not going to be transitory. So in my mind, it's already not transitory. I mean, people are suffering. Natural gas is up, 100%. Gasoline is up 50%. Cotton, hogs, everything that we buy is up a tremendous amount. So now the question becomes, if supply chain disruptions and supply shortages, if everything's a pendulum, and then by mid next year, all of a sudden we're talking about hugely built up supplies that all came in to take advantage of this, all of a sudden come to market at the same time we're tightening, then I could see Lacey Hunt's argument for certain. And I think it's very interesting. Right now I'm concerned with the bigger problem, which I think is inflation. And I will underscore the government spending into the teeth of inflation, which just is amazing to me how out of touch they can be economically.
I would take note of last week's John Deere union settlement. The price of oil that comes and goes, the price of hogs that comes and goes, but wages are sticky. And the settlement with the John Deere union provided them a very sizable immediate bonus, a 10% rate wage hike, then two more 5% wage hikes. So kind of the union and the rank and file and John Deere, for that matter, they know what's going on with inflation, even if our government won't admit it or the CPI doesn't measure it that well.
Okay, so caution, another 5 minute rant is about to happen. I'm sorry about this. You know, in the president's speech on Monday, he talked about he wanted an economy where companies compete for workers instead of workers competing for jobs. And he has it. And that's an eloquent way to say it, particularly when it's such awful and toxic policy. But there's a couple of things I want to point out, because everyone's like, oh, those the extended unemployment benefits are mostly gone. So how is the government competing for labor? And that's, I'll tell you how they're competing for labor. So three, according to Joe Barcellos from RSM, 3.2 million baby boomers have retired over expectations over the last year and a half. That must in fact be a function of asset prices going higher and the expectation of asset prices to continue going higher, you know, based on past performance. And that's government involvement. Also, this whole subculture has appeared of crypto traders who sit at home buying these Shiba Inu coins and thinking they're a genius and that's what they're going to do full time. But realistically, all they're doing is taking advantage of government money that's just been thrown into this, but that's boosting up all these asset prices. Then you get to student loan forbearance, eviction moratoriums, child tax credit. There's all these reasons that people aren't in any big hurry to go back to work. And now to tie it all up, now the corporations are competing. You mentioned John Deere having increased wages. I'm in the restaurant business. I have a restaurant, Brands of Palatine, Palatine, Illinois. So we and everyone's having to compete for labor. And once the wage portion of it starts to kick inflation, then they have what they've always dreamed about having, that wage-driven inflation cycle, which is the one that's difficult to reverse. So that's, if I was debating Lacey Hunt, which by the way, I'd be in over my head if I was debating Lacey Hunt, that would be one of my points, is that once the wage thing happens, as it looks like it's gonna, it's much harder to put the cat hat in the bag.
Right. And just, I'm glad you brought it back to Lacey Hunt, because it was a fascinating discussion, and I'm not going to do it justice. But, you know, I think his big point is that, you know, the level of indebtedness in this country as a percent of GDP is way above anything where the economy can sustain itself, and that all these, he believes all the government spending and Fed actions will prove temporary. And you mentioned shovel ready projects and Trump's tax cuts. And, you know, we get a little bump in economic activity, but over the longer period of time, you know, basically the government spending crowds out private sector activity, and there's less of a multiplier effect. And there go, you get stuck in this slow or no growth environment. And by the way, Europe and Japan are in even worse shape. They're further ahead, and we're kind of getting sucked into their downward spiral. That was,
wow. Yeah, you know, no, that sounds, yeah.
I like that
a lot.
Yeah, and I, you know, I left it thinking, ooh, that's, you know, that's not good. And he also talked about how what the Fed has done, basically all those assets are, quote unquote, as he put it, trapped in the financial markets, which makes sense. So we're exacerbating income inequality and not helping the people they say they want to help, the average worker.
Not even close. Yeah.
You know, I would encourage you and, you know, anyone who missed it to go back and listen to that, because it was a fascinating perspective, right or wrong. But the bottom line for him is he's still bullish on bonds and bullish on longer duration treasuries than anybody else we've talked to, for sure.
You know, I think as I hear it being broken down, I think because I'm more of a trader and he's more of a long-term macroeconomist, we may have different timeframes. What he's saying, I could see absolutely happening. I just don't think it's going to happen within the next year. But anytime you're going to say that the government's going to crowd out with their ridiculous spending and that's going to be an economic detriment, I agree. I think that everything they seem to be doing seems to have the exact opposite effect that they want it to. And you mentioned exacerbating wealth inequality, which does the average Joe realize that when they were getting their $1,400 check, guys like me, and I say this with no pride, but like all the assets that we hold are going through the roof.
Right.
They're not helping you with a $1,400 check. They're helping me by boosting my Amazon stock and my real estate holdings. And it's despicable. And, you know, I try to say this all the time, and I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying it's bad policy.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And, you know, we can go off on a very long rant and tangent on this point, but I think that issue, you know, the fact that the top 1%, I believe it is, now owns more stock than the bottom 80%, and, you know, including the middle class for the first time in history. That's the biggest problem in our society right now. And I could track almost all of the problems, political and otherwise, to that issue. but that's not what this show is about. So, you know, to your point, you know, the Fed, it's a blunt instrument, interest rates, right? And, you know, they can't address income inequality, but I'm sure they're going to be able to solve climate change through monetary policy. Certain. I mean, come on, like, yeah. Really? Yeah.
Well, they'll have us eating soy.
That's right. We'll go back to the soy turkey and soy Thanksgiving.
And can I just throw out one more inflation data point? And that's this morning, Dollar Tree is now $1.25. So
really?
Yeah,
that's interesting.
They're going to go to $1.25 price point after holding the line for I don't know how many decades.
And the stock's up a lot on that news.
Stock's
right?
up 6%. Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. And those anecdotal stories too make up. They're important. And I see it everywhere. Going out to dinner. I mean, everywhere you go, and I think a restaurant is a good way to gauge inflation too, just because our input costs are, you know, they're much more than just potatoes for French fries. You know, we buy energy, we buy a lot of different things at restaurants, and input costs have gone up immensely. And that's why prices had to rise. We had to raise prices at our restaurant. We're raising them again. And prices don't come down. I mean, they do maybe after a long period of time, but even when they talked about it being transitory, it's not like a restaurant raises prices and then 6 months later lowers them. They raise prices and then they don't. They just, the rate of inflation slows down, not the prices don't go down.
Right. Right. So I'm glad Stephen, as he often does, definitely brought us back to the markets, get me off my political soapbox.
Remember those? Right.
Yeah. So, but I'm going to ask you, Jim, what do you make of the fact that, so you have a retailer like Dollar Tree saying, we're going to raise prices, the stock goes up. When we saw the opposite happen with Target and Walmart, who basically said, we're holding line on prices, we're spending more to make sure our shelves are full for the holidays, and their stocks got punished for that last week or so.
They should get punished for that too. But I mean, that's part of this whole thing where the government seems like they want, you know, the Walmarts, Amazons, Targets, the big, huge retailers to consolidate the little ones because they can put the pressure on them. And you've seen speech after speech from the government talking about how raising prices is immoral, seeking profits and profit margin is immoral. Right. So, you know, perhaps Walmart and Target are taking those things to heart and not raising prices, which the market is telling them blatantly that that's not the right move at this point. You have to attempt to pass it on to consumer. And when we're starting to see consumer prices go up, but we saw producer prices go up, you know, a lot more before that. But I think these are all enormous issues, and they're enormous market issues too. And I think that's why we're going to shake out the stocks a little bit now, is worrying about these. But at the end of the day, I think that we realize that ultimately the Fed has our back. Ultimately, the government keeps spending. So that's why I think longer term, I'm okay with the stock market. Shorter term, I'm obviously not.
Right. And are you still in the there is no alternative camp?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. What else? What are you going to do with your money? There's, you know, they zero out interest rates everywhere. You know, they just force you further and further out the risk curve. You know, if there was a government bond that could give you 8%, you certainly wouldn't be buying as many meme stocks, I would think. I think that's basically my thesis since the great financial crisis has been there is no alternative, which is a sad thesis, by the way, because I mean, I'm a fan of the American economic engine, but I just think that pumping money into the system at the rate that they do ends up in risk assets. And that's why I'm long.
Yeah, I'm actually looking into the 6.5% coupon El Salvador bond.
Good call on that. Yeah,
the Bitcoin backed bond. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Good luck with that. For people listening, we are joking. We're not looking at El Salvadorian bonds, but okay. And they did announce a Bitcoin bond, right?
Yep,
that's a big deal. Yeah, that's a big deal because you know you start borrowing in that instrument, and then all of a sudden, you know, it gets a little bit more validity. And what I've talked about for a couple of years is institutional adoption validating cryptocurrencies. And I thought, like, I bought Ethereum the day it was announced that the Mercantile Exchange was launching their Ethereum futures contract. So now they have a Bitcoin futures contract and an Ethereum futures contract. And then you throw in, you know, like old blue blood, like the JP Morgans of the world, talking about, you know, getting into cryptocurrency and helping be custodians for their customers who own those things. So to me, that's every headline that breaks is another brick in the wall of building the case for cryptocurrency. And again, I'm not a religion. I don't have any tattoos of Dogecoins or anything, but I do think it could have a place.
Do you still have the laser eye photo that I sent you?
You do not. I reach in and I like what you said to me. I'm fighting being part of that religion. I want to just be my own religion still. I'm not going to be part of the Bitcoin army.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm only half joking about the El Salvador bond. It is super interesting. They're raising $1 billion. They're going to take $500 million of that and buy Bitcoin. They're going to take another $500 million and build this quote Bitcoin city. But it's interesting. There's tons of upside as opposed to like a convertible bond or something like that, which gets called if there's ever any real upside going on. There's massive upside in this if the price of Bitcoin keeps going up. There was a super interesting interview with this guy, Samson Mao, who's a top guy at Blockstream, which has kind of put together this bond deal. And the Bloomberg reporter kind of semi-hysterically were kind of like, well, what about the IMF? Don't they have a say in something like this? And he just looks at her stone with stone face and goes, no.
Wow. That's wild though, right?
Right.
Yeah. Because it's like rogue. It's like the Wild West currency. It's like, it's really like thumbing your nose at all the fiat currency and the stewardship of that currency and saying, we're just going rogue on you. And I think it's a really interesting time. And again, we joked about El Salvador, but to reiterate what your point, it's another brick in the wall of validating crypto.
So half jokingly, I am curious, when I see people like Odell Beckham Jr. or Aaron Rodgers, professional athletes, say we're taking part of our salary or all of our salary in cryptocurrencies, that makes me think we're closer to a peak than we are to the beginning of something. Am I missing something there?
No, you're absolutely right on that. So when you whiteboard out the pros and the cons, we had El Salvador being a pro, but those things are cons. When you start to see the less sophisticated money, it's just like Gisele Bündchen and wanting to be paid in euros back in the day.
Yep.
It definitely, to me, belongs on the side of peak. And again, I don't think they have peaked. But if I hear enough of those things, and just two of them, two or three of them is not that big a deal. But when I hear enough of those anecdotal stories, I'll begin to get worried. It's like, it's all about, back to the shoeshine boy and Joe Kennedy saying, he's put all his shoeshine profits in stocks. Right. So
your brother-in-law, the plumber. Yeah.
The brother-in-law, the plumber. Right. It's the same story, just different jobs. Exactly.
And there's the stadium naming rights too. I think crypto.com.
Right. Thank you. Yeah.
FTX,
yeah.
They're all over the stadium naming rights too. So that's all late 1999 with the Pac Bell stadiums and all that. And
yeah.
But
here's what I'll say to counter
Enron
that too.
Field. And I remember Enron Field too.
Gosh. Yeah, that's a good one. But here's what I'll say to counter that too, is for the Diamond Hands holders, they've gone through some nasty pullbacks in Bitcoin and have not capitulated. So to me, that's been impressive. I can't remember in 2017, was it like 20,000 down to 3,000? That's an amazing pullback that a lot of people just didn't sell and they kept. I mean, I hear from these people all the time saying, no, you guys are all wrong. I'm amazed. I've never seen an asset that had such fervent belief and they were willing to put their money behind that belief and lose their money behind that belief. So it's not, to me, it's not like stocks where you just, oh my gosh, you hit a button and all of a sudden you're out because you lost. These people seem to be a lot more convicted.
All right. So before we wrap, and as always, appreciate your time. I should know, once again, we're talking here midday Tuesday. Wednesday is a huge day for economic data. So short story, are you expecting, a busy day the day before Thanksgiving on the floor tomorrow?
I am, just because so much of the business, particularly in the rates markets, is driven from around the globe. So just the fact that it's the day before our holiday doesn't matter as much as it did at some point in time. So I'm expecting it to be a busy day too. But I will, I do think rates will probably continue higher. I think that's going to affect NASDAQ poorly. I think bank stocks, you guys seen bank stocks have done quite well on the news that rates are going higher, and probably that Lael Brainard isn't Fed chair because I think they assumed that she'd have a beef with the banking system. So those have done really well. And I like oil. Oil, it hit that 75 level off this. So I think those trends are going to continue now. And if you guys, I think it was on this show maybe months and months ago, at the beginning of this year, oil and banks were my picks to click for the year. And that's been a pretty decent trade. And I'm not done with it yet. But yeah, I guess you just asked me if tomorrow was going to be busy and I went into a bunch of different tangents. Yes. But yeah, but I think tomorrow's going to be busy is what.
Right. You reminded me also, we started talking about energy. So I'm glad you brought it back to that, because I don't know if I I can't recall if I said it earlier, but you have stocks like Apache, which is now APA, and Occidental up big today, which on the surface looks counterintuitive when you see that we've just released all these barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Do you think that maybe the Biden administration is waking up to the fact that maybe we should be encouraging more domestic production here?
No, no, I don't. Okay. I think he's going to get fought completely like that. But this is something that you hit on that's interesting. So they go out and they regulate these companies, the ExxonMobil's, ConocoPhillips, like the, and you know, Apache, all of them. So, but what happens in turn then is they drive the price of crude oil up. Now, the market looks at the price of crude oil going up and knows that those names trade in a pre-correlation with crude, even if they shouldn't. So then they start buying those names. So this is one of the things I love, a quirk of markets, where the things that are being regulated tend to rally with the crude, even though they shouldn't. You know what I mean? It's like back when Moody's downgraded U.S. debt. And then it caused a panic in a lot of markets. And then as a safe haven bet, people bought U.S. debt. So at the end of the day, because it was the very thing that was downgraded, rallied because of the downgrade. You know what I mean? It's kind of a weird market quirk.
Right. And are you now or are you long energy stocks? Or are you more, you trade the futures? You are. Okay.
No, I'm long energy stocks. I'm long ConocoPhillips. I'm long ExxonMobil. I'm long that one ETF that has a bunch of the names in it. I can't remember which one it is, but I bought those things at the beginning of the year. I bought them for a trade at the time, but they've graduated into an investment.
All right. And then I keep saying I'm going to wrap, but I have more questions for you. I promise last one, unless Stephen has more. Tech, you know, big cap tech is getting, you know, beat up a little bit here last day or two, but the NDX was up over 25% heading into this week, outpacing the S&P 500. I don't think that was consensus among, you know, on Wall Street heading into this year. What's to say next year isn't going to be a repeat?
Well, because rates are going to be higher. And part of the thing that was baked in, remember when we rallied, it was work from home, digital world. You know, this I'm talking about the last year and a half rally, coupled with the facts that rates were going to be low for a long, long time. And all these, you know, Wall Street have their discounted cash flow models, which favors growth stocks if rates are low and disproportionately unfavors them when rates start to go higher. So if you believe that rates are going to be sitting at higher levels, which I do, that could weigh on tech stocks. So I'm not, I mean, I still have some investment portfolios, but I'm going to look more Russell and more broader things and away from tech stocks going forward into 2022.
Okay. And we look forward to having you back on to talk more about that. Our guest has been Jim Urio. He is managing director of TJM Institutional Services. He's a restaurateur and a provocateur on Twitter. Jim, thanks for being here and have a great holiday.
You too. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jim.